He had the mansion, the money, and a last name that ruled South Carolina's courtrooms for over a century. But behind closed doors, Grayson Bellamy was drowning, in debt, in secrets, in a storm of lies too deep to escape. When his wife and son were found shot dead on their rural estate, the truth that unraveled shocked the South and captivated the world. This is no ordinary crime story. This is a confession from the man who once had it all and chose murder to protect the empire he built on fraud. Welcome to the chilling descent of a Southern legend. Welcome to the Murder Tape Chronicles. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Blood Ties, Confessions of a Southern Betrayal. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The House That Raised Me. I used to believe that some men were born to carry legacies the way others carry burdens, quietly, with reverence. My father believed that too. His father before him. In the Lowcountry of South Carolina, where oak trees outlived men and land passed through generations like sacred scripture, legacy was everything. The Bellamy name was carved into courthouse stone, into church pews, into the flesh and memory of this town. We weren't just another family, we were the family. And me? I was the heir. Grayson Langford Bellamy III. A name too heavy for a cradle, too rigid for a boy, and far too sharp for the man I became. The house I was raised in stood at the edge of Wren's Hollow, a grand colonial plantation seated on nearly 200 acres of pine forest, marshland, and silent, blood-soaked history. The front porch alone spanned 40 feet, the kind of place where men smoked cigars and made backdoor political deals in the quiet. Spanish moss hung like drapes from the massive oak trees out front. At dusk, the wind would rustle through them like whispers from ghosts that hadn't yet decided to leave. Everything about the Bellamy estate was designed to impress and intimidate, from the antique chandeliers imported from Italy to the mahogany paneling polished so perfectly it reflected your sins right back at you. And somewhere between the oil paintings of our ancestors and the shelves lined with leather-bound legal tomes, I learned exactly who I was supposed to be. Polished, powerful, untouchable. And for a long time, I played that role so well I almost believed it. I graduated top of my class from UVA, passed the bar with ease, and returned home to take my seat at the firm my grandfather founded, Bellamy, Holt & Crane. You couldn't swing a dead gator in Culloden County without hitting someone who owed us their freedom, their fortune, or their silence. I married Laurel Sinclair 2 years after I made partner. Laurel was delicate, the kind of woman men protected, not because she was weak, but because she moved through the world like she wasn't meant to be touched by it. Blonde curls, soft voice, eyes like glass, always watching, never judging. We had a son, Tyler, a year later. My boy. My legacy. The fourth in the line, if fate had allowed it. But fate didn't, because fate has a sick sense of humor. You see, beneath the polished mahogany of my life, termites were chewing at the foundations. Debt. Betrayal. Addiction, not to drugs or booze, but to control. To the illusion that I was bigger than the house that raised me. And once that illusion started to crack, everything else followed. It started with a client, a wrongful death case with a fat settlement. The family never saw their full payout. I diverted a portion into a shadow account. Just enough to patch a hole, I told myself. No one would miss it. No one did. Not at first. But the thing about darkness? It doesn't arrive all at once. It creeps in, slow and quiet, until one day you wake up and realize you haven't seen daylight in years. The scheme grew. I began redirecting funds from other settlements, created dummy corporations, donated to fake charities. I built an entire empire of deception right beneath the noses of the people who trusted me the most. And Laurel? She knew something was off. I could see it in the way she looked at me over dinner, in the way her hands lingered too long on the stem of her wine glass, as if anchoring herself to something real. She didn't ask questions. Not directly. Southern women are taught not to stir the waters unless they're ready to drown. But Tyler? He was different. Sharp. Observant. Dangerous. In the way smart kids can be when they smell bullshit in a family built on image. By the time he turned 18, he'd grown distant. He stopped talking to me unless he had to. Started keeping journals. He was asking questions. About the firm. About the finances. Laurel found one of his notebooks. I read it. Page after page of names, case numbers, figures that no 18-year-old should have had access to. My hands started shaking, and not from guilt, from fear. Everything I had built, my name, my empire, my illusion, was one good journalist, one curious son, or one heartbroken wife away from collapse. So I made a decision, a cold, surgical decision, not out of anger, not out of hate, but out of necessity. I didn't want to lose everything, so I took everything from them instead. I remember the night in pieces, the way trauma often works. Laurel was in the kitchen, humming to herself, barefoot, the smell of bourbon and rosemary thick in the air. Tyler was out on the back porch, scrolling through his phone, headphones in. It was raining, thunder in the distance, slow and rolling. I remember the weight of the gun, the way the metal pressed into my palm, the way the house felt stiller than usual, like even the ghosts were holding their breath. I stepped onto the porch. Tyler looked up, and that was the last time I saw my son alive. Chapter 2, What the Water Buried. Some people believe that killing someone changes you in an instant. That's a lie. It doesn't hit like a bullet. It seeps in, slow, thick, quiet, like oil leaking through the cracks of your soul. And by the time you realize you're drowning in it, you're already beneath the surface. The moment Tyler hit the floor, I didn't scream. I didn't run. I just stood there, soaked in silence, the gun still warm in my hand. He didn't even have time to beg. 18 years, and I silenced them in under 2 seconds. The rain had started to pour harder, drumming against the wooden planks of the porch like it was trying to wash the blood away before it could settle into the grain. I looked down at my boy, my only child, and for the first time in years, I couldn't feel anything. No rage, no grief, just an eerie stillness, like my soul had stepped out of the room to avoid witnessing what I'd done. Laurel came outside seconds later. She didn't scream either. She froze in the doorway, barefoot, her lips parting like she was about to say my name. But nothing came out. Just a soundless exhale, like the last bit of hope leaving her lungs. She knew. Not because of the blood, or the body, or the gun. She knew because she'd been watching me unravel for years. She took one small step forward, and I shot her too. It wasn't calculated. It wasn't planned. It was necessary. If she had lived, she would have exposed everything. The money. The fraud. The tangled mess of fake charities, off-the-books deals, and the dozens of manipulated settlements that were funding our perfect Southern life. And worse, she would have told them about Tyler's notebook, about the truth buried inside our marble-floored house. She collapsed next to him like the universe was trying to reunite them in death the way I had failed them in life. Her hair stuck to her face in clumps, blood mixing with rain. Her eyes were wide open, locked on mine, even as the light inside them vanished. I stepped back, slipped slightly on the wet porch. It was the first time I felt something. Not guilt, panic. Not for what I'd done, but for what had to happen next. The cleanup, the cover-up, the performance. I wiped the gun with gloves I had stashed in my coat pocket. I'd rehearsed that part in my head a dozen times. I wrapped it in thick plastic, duct-taped it like I was sealing up a wound I refused to let bleed. I knew where I was going. The swamp behind Wren's Hollow was over 80 acres wide, unmapped, wild, choked with gators, snakes, and enough secrets to write 100 Southern Gothic novels. It was the place where my great-grandfather used to dump the carcasses of animals he'd hunted for sport. A place forgotten by time, and now by the law. I loaded the gun into the back of my truck, and for the first time in my life, I felt grateful for the storm. It blanketed everything. My tracks, my scent, even the distant whimper of grief still crawling through my chest like a feral dog. The drive was long. Too long. Every bump in the road felt like a scream I couldn't muffle. I drove without headlights most of the way, steering by memory and instinct. No one would be out there. Not in that weather. Not in that hour. I parked deep in the brush, beyond the old hunting trail. Got out. Waded into the muck. The water swallowed me to the knees, cold and black, like ink from a pen writing my sins into the earth itself. I found an old stump, one I used to sit on when I was a boy, listening to my father lie about justice and honor, and I buried the gun beneath it. No prayers. No hesitation. Just silence. The swamp didn't ask questions. It just took. By the time I made it back home, dawn was breaking. The storm had cleared, but the air still tasted like static, like the world was holding its breath. I stood at the edge of the porch for a long time, staring at them, Laurel and Tyler. Still, lifeless, together. And that's when it hit me, not regret. Not love, but strategy. I had to become the grieving husband, the broken father. I had to cry on command, collapse into the arms of the sheriff I used to hunt deer with every fall. I had to make them believe that I was just as lost as they were. So I did. I called 911. I sobbed into the phone. I held Laurel's cold hand until the sirens arrived. And when the paramedics rushed up the porch, when the sheriff pulled me into a hug, when the forensics team started snapping photos, I stayed in character. Grayson Bellamy, the man who lost everything. Not Grayson Bellamy, the man who destroyed it. The media came next. Local news trucks, then national stations. The headlines were predictable. Prominent attorney's wife and son murdered on family estate. They played photos from our Christmas cards. Showed footage of Tyler playing football. Interviewed Laurel's friends from the garden club. No one suspected me. Not yet. But the questions were coming. I could feel them in the way the sheriff squinted at me just a little too long. In the way the DA whispered when she thought I wasn't listening. In the way the marshy wind carried secrets through the trees like they were itching to be heard. And then came the mistake. Not mine. The coroner's. He filed the time of death on Tyler a full 15 minutes before the 911 call. 15 minutes. 15 goddamn minutes. That's all it took to unravel everything I had just sewn together with lies. But I smiled. I buried my panic deeper than that gun. And I told myself one thing, over and over again. Stay calm, Grayson. The storm may be loud, but you are louder. Chapter 3. The Unraveling. There's a certain quiet that settles over a man when he knows he's being hunted. Not in the literal sense, not yet. But something darker. Heavier. It's the silence that comes right before your name becomes poison in the mouth of every person you've ever shaken hands with. The kind of silence that crawls under your skin and whispers they know. They're coming. After Laurel and Tyler were buried. And I mean that literally, with matching caskets, weeping townsfolk, and a church packed so full it felt like Judgment Day had come early. I thought I had done it. I thought I'd played the role, so well the curtain would never fall. But deep down, somewhere in the pit of the man I used to be, I knew that curtain was already burning. I remember standing at the pulpit, looking out at a sea of faces. Most of them were familiar, judges, lawyers, deputies, former clients, people who owed me their freedom or feared I could take it from them. They all sat there in their Sunday best, clutching tissues, nodding solemnly. And I cried, right on cue. Hell, I should have won a damn Emmy. I talked about Laurel's grace and kindness, about Tyler's limitless potential. I told the story of how Laurel once drove through a hurricane just to bring a stray dog to the vet. People ate that shit up. I even got a standing ovation at the end. But the thing about performances? They always end. And once the audience leaves, all you're left with is the echo. A week after the funeral, I started noticing the shift. The DA, Elena Kessler, stopped returning my calls. The managing partner at Bellamy, Holt and Crane, my own damn firm, began scheduling closed-door meetings without me. I walked in on one once. The room went silent. No one met my eyes. Not even James Cartwright, who I'd pulled out of bankruptcy 6 years prior. Then came the financial audits. At first, I thought it was routine. A compliance check. A box to tick. But then my assistant, Anna, sweet girl, came to me with a look on her face that I will never forget. She was holding a thick folder, trembling like she was holding live TNT. Grayson, she whispered, like saying it louder would set the place on fire. They're looking at everything. The folder was from a forensic accountant the firm had hired behind my back. A specialist. The kind of guy you bring in when you suspect someone of robbing you blind. Inside were spreadsheets. Dozens of them. Wire transfers. Irregularities. Gaps in ledgers. Shell corporations tied to accounts I hadn't touched in years. They had dug deep, and they were getting close, too close. That night, I didn't sleep. I poured bourbon until my hands stopped shaking and stared out over the marsh as if the answers were floating in the mist. I knew the truth couldn't stay buried forever. But I didn't expect it to surface all at once. What I didn't realize, what I couldn't realize, was that Tyler had shared his notebook with someone. A girl. A classmate named Shelby Griggs. She showed up at the sheriff's office one afternoon, crying, terrified. Said she'd been too scared to come forward before, but Tyler had confided in her. Said he believed I was hiding millions. That he had proof. She handed over photocopies, pages from his notebook. Names. Amounts. Dates. Even a rough sketch of the fraud map I'd created in my head years ago. It was damning. And that was the beginning of the end. Within 24 hours, the FBI was knocking at my door. They were polite. respectful, even, but their eyes were cold, calculating. One of them asked me about a charity foundation I'd set up in Laurels named 3 years prior, the Southern Hope Foundation. Said they'd found a link between the foundation's donations and a private account in the Caymans. I told them it was a mistake. They told me it wasn't. The firm suspended me that afternoon. The same people who toasted to my victories, who shook my hand in court and called me brother, turned their backs so fast it was like I never existed. By the end of that week, I was no longer the attorney. I was the suspect. The media ran with it like wolves. Southern Powerhouse under federal investigation. Bellamy Empire crumbles. Whispers of murder behind mansion walls. Every anchor had their version. Every podcast had a theory. Some said Laurel was the real brains behind the operation. Others claimed Tyler had uncovered my scheme and I silenced him to protect my name. They didn't know how close they were to the truth. But the worst part, the part that keeps me up even now, is that the house turned on me. My house, the Bellamy Estate, once a sanctuary, became a tomb. Rooms started to feel colder. The lights flickered more often. The wind outside began to sound like voices. Laurel's soft southern hum, Tyler's laughter. I started seeing things in reflections, shadows that didn't move with me. I stopped sleeping in the master bedroom, slept on the couch in the study, like some aging drunk who'd overstayed his welcome at a stranger's home. And maybe I had. I remember one night in particular. The thunder rolled in slow, like judgment. I was staring at an old photograph. Laurel and Tyler at the beach, both of them laughing, wind in their hair. I was behind the camera that day. I remember how happy they looked. How far away that version of them seemed now. I threw the frame across the room. Watched the glass shatter like a gunshot. It felt good, for a second. And then it felt hollow. The indictment came the next morning. Wire fraud. Embezzlement. Obstruction. And, God help me, suspicion of homicide. The sheriff didn't even cuff me when he arrived. He looked tired. Broken. Like this wasn't just another arrest. It was a funeral for the man he thought he knew. You want to say anything, Grayson? He asked me. I looked out at the marsh, the way I always had. My kingdom. My curse. And I said the only thing I could. Not yet. Chapter 4. The verdict echoes. They say when the gavel falls, it echoes through your bones. But truth be told, I never heard the gavel. What I heard was silence. The kind that only comes when every lie you've ever told finally stops fighting to survive. And in that silence, all I could hear was the verdict. One single word, repeated twice. Guilty. Double homicide. Wire fraud. Conspiracy. The judge's voice faded into static as the courtroom around me erupted into a chorus of gasps, muffled sobs, and the frantic scribbling of journalists who couldn't believe they'd just witnessed the fall of a dynasty. I didn't flinch. Didn't blink. I just sat there, frozen in my own skin, my hands resting neatly on the defense table, palms up, like I was waiting for something divine to intervene. Nothing came. But before the verdict, before that final nail was driven into the coffin of my name, there was the trial. And God, what a trial it was. It was theater. Spectacle. The ultimate Southern drama. Cameras in the hallways, helicopters overhead. You couldn't step outside the courthouse without someone yelling, "Murderer!" or "Liar!" or asking for a selfie. Netflix had a goddamn production van parked outside for 2 weeks. They called it the fall of the Bellamy bloodline. I called it karma. The courtroom itself felt colder every day. Even when the sun poured through the high arched windows, it felt like frost coated the walls. My seat at the defense table may as well have been a goddamn execution chair. Every eye in the room was watching me, not as a man, but as a symbol, a relic of everything people love to hate, wealth, power, legacy, all turned rotten. My defense team was top tier. The kind of legal muscle you can only afford if you've been screwing the system long enough to know where the soft spots are. We crafted a narrative. I was the victim, an overwhelmed man, financially strained, betrayed by shady business partners and grieving the loss of his family. I had lost my mind, not my soul. That was the pitch. But it didn't land. Because across the aisle, the prosecution had Elena Kessler, the same woman I'd once mentored. I taught her how to question witnesses, how to bait a jury, how to win with silence. And she turned every one of those lessons against me like a blade to the throat. She was ruthless, elegant, patient, and she had receipts, financial records, fake charities, the trail of offshore accounts. But more than that, she had Shelby Griggs, the girl Tyler had trusted, the one who held the key to everything. Shelby took the stand on the fifth day of trial. Her voice trembled at first, but when she looked me in the eye, something in her steadied. "He told me his father wasn't who people thought he was," she said. "Tyler told me he was scared." The courtroom went dead quiet. She held up a copy of his notebook, showed them entries, figures, diagrams, even a doodle, Laurel's necklace sketched next to a dollar sign. It wasn't just evidence. It was a confession from the grave. And that's when the tide shifted. The jury started watching me differently. Less like a defendant, more like a snake in a tailored suit. I could feel the space between me and the rest of the world widen, as if the very air was separating me from humanity. I took the stand on the ninth day. My lawyers advised against it. But I had to try. Had to at least pretend I gave a damn. "Mr. Bellamy," Elena asked, pacing slowly, "did you love your wife and son?" I hesitated, not because I didn't know the answer, but because I did. "Yes," I said, and for the first time in years, I meant it. "Then explain this," she said, sliding two autopsy photos onto the table in front of me like a goddamn executioner unveiling the blade. I couldn't look. I tried to keep my voice steady. Tried to talk about stress, about blackouts, about how grief can twist reality. I even let a tear slide down my cheek. But it was all theater, and they could smell the lie in it. Then came the coroner. He broke me, because his testimony was clinical, cold, unbiased. He spoke about angles, blood spatter, gun residue, and then he said it. The victim, Tyler Bellamy, was shot at close range. The shooter was someone he trusted. Silence. I couldn't breathe. Not because I was shocked, but because the room suddenly felt like it was underwater. Every sound came through muffled. Every breath tasted like chlorine and metal. Then Laurel's sister testified. Said Laurel had suspected something for months. Said she was planning to leave. Said she was afraid. That's when I knew I was done. The final witness was the financial analyst. He brought graphs. Fucking graphs. Projected on a giant screen, he traced every dollar. Every shell corporation. Every transfer. Every missing cent. The jurors stared at those charts like they were looking into the soul of the devil himself. By the time closing arguments rolled around, my defense was already writing my appeal. And then came the jury. They deliberated for less than 4 hours. For hours to destroy 48 years of my life. For hours to turn my last name into a curse. When the judge read the verdict, the gavel never reached my ears. Because I was already hearing something else. My father's voice. From years ago. "You carry this name with pride, Grayson. Never tarnish it." And now, the name Bellamy was etched in blood. Not in marble. Not in gold. In blood. The judge looked at me with something close to disgust. "Mr. Bellamy," he said, "for the crimes of which you've been found guilty, double homicide, financial conspiracy, obstruction, you are hereby sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms without the possibility of parole." The courtroom didn't erupt. It didn't gasp. It breathed. Like it had been holding its lungs for weeks, waiting for this very moment to exhale. The bailiff moved toward me. I stood. My hands were cuffed. Click. Metal on skin. And just like that, the curtain fell. Chapter 5. Confession from a Cell. They say prison is where men go to repent. That's bullshit. Prison isn't a place for redemption. It's a graveyard for the living. A purgatory with flickering lights, metal toilets, and memories that won't stop clawing at your goddamn throat. I've been here for 13 months now. Cell Block E, South Ridge Correctional. Concrete walls. No view. Just a slit of reinforced glass above the cot that shows a sliver of sky I've watched turn from gray to black and back again more times than I can count. There's a rust stain on the floor near the drain. I clean it with my toothbrush every week. It never fades. Just like the stain in my chest where Laurel and Tyler used to live. I don't speak to the other inmates. Most don't speak to me either. They know who I am. Not because of what I did, but because of who I was. Grayson Bellamy. Southern elite. Courtroom titan. The man who murdered his perfect little family in the rain. Some of the guards call me senator. Some call me psycho. One just calls me ghost. And he's not wrong. Because I'm not really here. Not all of me. The part of me that mattered, the husband, the father, the architect of a legacy, that part was buried the moment I pulled the trigger. What's left is a hollow version of that man, made of court transcripts and newspaper clippings, and the screams I still hear at 2 a.m. when the lights shut off and the silence becomes unbearable. I get letters sometimes. Most of them are hate mail. People telling me I deserve to rot, that I should have been given the needle, that I took everything good from the world and left behind a stain too big to wash off. I agree with them. Every single word. But one letter broke me. It came from Laurel's sister, Elaine. Pale blue paper. The kind you'd find in an old church office. The handwriting was careful, almost surgical. She didn't curse me. She didn't threaten me. She just wrote one sentence. You didn't kill them to hide your crimes, Grayson. You killed them because they reminded you of what you used to be. And she was right. Tyler reminded me of youth. Of hope. Of a time when I believed I could be a better man than my father. He saw through the mask. Saw the cracks. And Laurel, she reminded me of love. The kind that didn't ask for power or perfection. Just presence. And I hadn't been present for years. Because I was too busy becoming a monster my father would be proud of. They say guilt fades. But they don't know what real guilt is. Real guilt is remembering the sound your son made when he looked up from his phone and saw the gun in your hand. Real guilt is feeling your wife's body go cold before the rain can even hit her skin. Real guilt is waking up every morning in a bed too hard to dream in, with a meal tray you don't touch, and the image of your family etched into your eyelids like punishment. And the worst part, some days I don't feel it. Some days I wake up, and there's nothing. Just the smell of bleach and sweat and rust. And on those days, I miss the guilt, because it's the only thing that proves I'm still human. I've been asked to do interviews, podcasts, documentaries, even a book deal. They want to know my side, the real story. But this is the real story. You're hearing it now. Not polished for prime time, not softened for ratings, just raw, just real. From the mouth of a man who destroyed everything he ever loved just to preserve a legacy that was already rotting beneath his feet. I don't want sympathy. Don't even want understanding. I just want the truth out there. I want some kid in a suit, fresh out of law school, reading about me in some ethics class, to feel what this path leads to. Because this isn't power. This isn't control. This is hell. A slow, suffocating hell made of cinder blocks and consequences. I've been writing letters to Tyler. Every week. Never mailed them. Just folded them into a notebook I keep under my mattress. I write to Laurel too. I tell them everything now. Every detail. Every lie I told. Every dollar I stole. Every moment I wish I could go back and undo. I ask for their forgiveness. And I never feel like I deserve it. But I write anyway. Because it's all I have. One day, maybe the letters will stop. Maybe I'll stop. But not today. Today, I sit in this cage and speak into this recorder. I don't know who's listening. Maybe no one. Maybe you. Maybe someone just like me. And if you are, let me leave you with this. The most dangerous men in the world aren't the ones who scream. They're the ones who smile while they're sharpening the knife. They're the ones who stand at the head of the table, say grace, pour the wine, and kill you with a whisper. I used to be that man. Now I'm just a ghost in an orange jumpsuit. And I deserve every second of it.